we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we're going to be looking at episode 2 of series 8 of Doctor Who, starring Peter Capaldi as the Doctor and his episode Into the Dalek. Start with a synopsis. The Doctor comes to the aid of a space pilot, Journey Blue, who is about to be killed by the Daleks. He rescues her, only to be forced into helping a damaged Dalek aboard their ship, the Aristotle. This Dalek is so damaged it has become good and wants to destroy all the Daleks. The Doctor retrieves Clara from the Coal Hill School, where she's flirting with a new school teacher, an ex-soldier, Danny Pink. Aboard the medical ship Aristotle, the Doctor, Clara, Journey, and two troopers are miniaturized and inserted into the Dalek to see if they can repair it. The Doctor finds the malfunction, but when he repairs it, the Dalek returns to its normal pattern of evil ways and brings the Dalek mothership to the hidden Aristotle. The battle breaks out, and the human forces are being destroyed. The Doctor tries, and succeeds, in recreating the circumstances that turned the Dalek good. The Dalek turns on his fellows and repels the Dalek invasion. He then goes to take his place amongst the Daleks with the intent to destroy them all. Well, let's start with a simple one. What did you think of the episode?
I really enjoyed this one, I have to say. I wasn't expecting to. The premise is fairly obvious. You know, we're going to get a version of Inner Space, except set inside a Dalek. And I was thinking, oh, you know, here we go.
Inner space. Oh, yeah. There's inner space, too. I made my kids watch Fantastic Voyage before this.
Oh, yeah. No, that's probably more what it was. Because the Doctor does make reference to this would be a good synopsis for a film.
So he actually said it would make a fantastic movie. This is his exact word.
So that's...
but yes. A terrible idea for a proctologist.
Yes.
Which, that line was above my kids.
several good lines, I thought. Some really good lines. But overall, a plot that was both satisfying because it kept avoiding going down too obvious a path and yet brought things to a conclusion that seemed to me to keep the fundamental notion of a Dalek intact.
Mm-hmm.
And also... I know this is a bit of a cliche for Dalek stories, but it did make the Dalek scary again. And although there have been one or two other stories that has been said of, there have been a lot of Dalek stories that are fairly duff. And, you know, coming out of it, admittedly, after one viewing, for me, I think this has got to be the best Dalek story since Genesis.
Wow, that's going a long time back. I admit I'm not particularly enamored of most of the Dalek stories because they're either made to be too big of a threat, a la anything to do with the Time War. So yep. I'm just not convinced they could take on the Time Lords. Not the Time Lords we know and knew, you know, in days of old. And at the same time, they've had to make them out that big and then... Is how is it that the Daleks can take on the Time Lords to not just a draw, but they're going to win. They are defeating the Time Lords. And yet we have a 50-year history of the Doctor by himself defeating the Daleks time and time and time and time again. So one Time Lord, no problem. The entire species, they're going to lose with the Doctor fighting on their side, or the War Doctor fighting on their side. So the Daleks have always been a problematic. I liked the mixture that we got here. There's the rebels are beat largely because they're grossly outnumbered.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when they're fighting the Daleks, when the Daleks are invading the ship, I loved the fact that the rebels killed one. I think they only blew one up. But the point is, it's not a completely hopeless battle, but it's darn near. And I think that puts the Daleks at a good level.
Yeah, but it's hopeless because it's well set up. You've got an enormous Dalek spaceship, which by sheer weight of numbers is bound to wipe them out. I mean, they could have killed several, but they wouldn't have stood a chance.
Right.
Their only hope is the fact that they are hidden in the asteroid belt.
Exactly.
And that's the setup. So, you know, that is a genuinely scary prospect.
I think we probably saw something like 15 to 20 to 1. So they killed about 15 to 20 humans. Mm-hmm. Humans got one Dalek.
Yeah.
So, you know, given overwhelming forces on the human side, then Daleks are not invincible. But at the same time, given a fair fight, obviously, if, you know, a one-to-one fight, the Daleks are going to win. It makes them a credibly very strong threat, but not the universe-crushing threat that we saw. So, yeah, no, I did like that part about this. I thought that was a good balance for the Daleks, although they were still pretty lousy shots.
Yes. Yes.
I thought they were incapable of missing. But, I mean, except when they're shooting at the Doctor because of, I don't know why, but... yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the episode. I don't generally like Dalek stories anyway, so it was a better Dalek story. I'll go so far as that. Now, I think you know, I have seen the scripts, and I mentioned in last week's podcast that I liked the script better than I did the actual finished episode because of the way some of the things were played. Kind of feel that way again, this time, a little bit. I think Peter Capaldi's lines are more understated than I expected they would. That's interesting because I think I've mentioned to you, I've, you know, read most of the Target novelizations long before I saw the books, and I didn't have anything like that in my mind. But in this case, I do. And I'm not sure whether that's my expectations are wrong or whether, well, I don't know. But, you know, it's even lines like, for example, in the scene where Journey Blue is telling the Doctor, you know, we brought you in here to fix the Dalek or whoever, and look what's happened. And the Doctor's response is, I give it a shot. It didn't work out. It's very unemotionally played, disinterested, detached, almost clinical. And perhaps that's not quite what I expected it to be played. There's a lot of lines that he gives that are very clinical. And it's not that they're bad, it's just probably not what I expected. And so it does tend to take the excitement level or the energy level down a bit when I'm watching the episode. So I'm having to deal with that, but I'm not even sure if that's a problem. I'm enjoying Capaldi's characterization just fine. It's just odd that I'm not quite connecting with... I really loved the scripts, all but one of them. Of the first five, and then that one was fine. I know we're going to be a fight over it, but
say no more.
Nope.
Won't. But I mean, apart from the fact that obviously I'm phobic of any spoilers in future scripts, I've come to this one without any expectations. I loved Capaldi's performance in this even more than I did in the last one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, partly what we're obviously getting here is a bit of regular Doctor.
Right.
So the reason that I'm liking it is because last time I was just enjoying the performance. But every Doctor, as you know, we've been through all those regeneration episodes, every Doctor gets a chance to do the whole mad regeneration thing and not play necessarily what we're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing
jumble.
They're working through something, aren't they? So we get some quite extreme performances or whatever, and that was fascinating for Capaldi. But at the end of it, I really didn't know quite what we would get from the kind of regular Doctor, if you like. And in this, we got something of an answer to that, and I really liked it. But it wasn't like the Doctors that we've had previously, and partly that is how it's written, and partly there's an extra layer to that, which is how he delivers mm-hmm. it. And some of it was really quite dark. You know, he's the top layer, if you want to say a few words. He's and it is how Capaldi delivers it. He's very offhand about that. And giving the guy the thing to swallow.
Oh, I love that.
You know, saying trust me. And then he's it's just that it's not what you expect, because we've kind of got used to fairly emo Doctors, if I could put it like that, who are going to say, I'm so, so sorry, I couldn't save you. He's giving it none of that. He couldn't do anything about it. He's busy. He's got problems to solve. Move on.
It's pragmatic. And
yeah, exactly. But also quite, you know, not human.
Inhuman's the right word, yeah.
Not what we expect from the normal human response to be, the normal emotional response. And yes, there are members of our species who do not necessarily respond in that way, but a lot of them are psychopaths. So
mm-hmm.
that's quite an interesting aspect we're getting to his character here. And that to me is quite a brave thing to do, because I mean, I've said one of the reasons that I loved David Tennant was because I felt that you could see in his performance all the previous Doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that there's anything like what we're getting from Capaldi here. And yet he is the Doctor. I'm totally accepting he is the Doctor. And I'm really enjoying that fact of being surprised and not quite knowing what he's going to come out with next or how he's going to react. It's really exciting.
Well, one thing that I derived, and I will go so far as to say I had derived this from the time I got to the second script. So I'm not spoilery on beyond because of this. Mm-hmm. My feel as I read the script was an amalgamation of Pertwee and Colin Baker, or at least what they were trying to do with Colin Baker.
Yeah, well, I certainly got a lot of that from Deep Breath. Well, I was expecting it, to be honest, from comments that had been made, that there would be a kind of attempt to do with 12 what had been attempted with six
and didn't work because of
yeah,
variety stuff. Of reasons. But yeah, but to back to the script, I did mention it last week, but I'll mention it again. When I read the script, the Doctor jumps off the bridge, swims across the Thames. In my mind, he's like an active dive and a power swim across the Thames. In the episode, it's sort of a slightly foot-first dropping, completely almost unseen, and just some ripply water. He's more active in my mind than he is on camera. So a lot of,
yes.
And that's kind of the understated part here is taken out when his plays. It's taking the Pertwee out of the performance that I was kind of expecting, but the Colin Baker is still there.
Well, yes, except I don't think that either Pertwee or Baker would have done the "Am I a good man?" scene. There's another dimension to this Doctor, which is partly the lack of confidence, which I think is quite a challenging thing to do, because one of the reasons we take to the Doctor is because he is so confident and he knows the answers and he's going to come up with the solution and all the rest of it. And it can be quite, well, trying, to be honest, to watch a character who's completely full of self-doubt all the time.
Let's talk about the am I a good man. Clara's answer is, I don't know. Really? I mean, is there any doubt? Should there be any doubt? You know, ignoring the fact that Clara is the companion who's seen every Doctor. Would she have doubted that question for Matt Smith's Doctor? If he'd said, am I a good man, would she have said no? Is she referring specifically to Capaldi's Doctor, or is she referring to the Doctor as a whole, for starters?
I assume she's referring to the Doctor as a whole, though it's interesting. I mean, I do have some problems because I think that Clara seems to have forgotten some things about the Doctor in Deep Breath to do
with,
you know, his having aged and his having had previous changes. So it's hard feeling that they didn't really reconcile what Clara had been shown to know in previous episodes with what she knows now, to know exactly what the intention is here. But my instinctive reaction is she's talking about the Doctor, not a specific regeneration of the Doctor.
Do we have any credible reason to believe that she would be going along with somebody who she doesn't think is at least somewhat good? I mean, is the opposite of good bad? Am I a good person? I don't know why I'm hanging out with you. I just like bad boys. I don't know. I mean,
it sounds like a simple question. It is a more complicated question.
And
what springs to mind is, and if you haven't seen this, there's a cartoon called Dog Philosophy. So Google Three Panel Soul and Dog Philosophy. It's a brilliant, brilliant cartoon. And I don't want to spoil it here.
So this punchline's, you know, not going anywhere. No.
No, it's not. It's just saying, this is what's in my mind. Read the cartoon. What I'm thinking is, what is goodness? What does the Doctor actually mean? Because it's not a simple question.
No.
And the glib and reassuring answer would obviously be, well, yes. But Clara doesn't say that. She stops and thinks about it.
And says, I don't
whether,
know.
Whether she really doesn't know, or whether she doesn't have an instant answer to give is the question there. I think she could come up with an answer, but it would be more complicated than just saying yes.
Well, I think this whole episode has, I mean, that question is layered at many levels. And it, of course, at the end, she says, I don't know, but I think you try. And that seems to satisfy the Doctor or reassure him. So perhaps trying to be good is good.
Perhaps. I mean, that comes back to the Prime Directive question.
Because okay.
The reason you will defend that is based on good intentions, isn't it?
Yep.
So if that's not trying to be good, I don't know what is. And yet, clearly, the Doctor does things that are sometimes, from some perspectives, not good. You know,
I tried to have this, and I'll try to play it in if I can edit it up in such a way. I tried to test this one to my daughter about the nature of good and bad, and this is being played out at several levels in this episode. And the first level is his seeming hatred of soldiers. Now, you know, despite what an individual person may say, generally speaking, soldiers are not held up as evil. Soldiers on your side are there to help defend and protect in circumstances that require the use of something that we would consider unacceptable. War is a thing that the actions committed in war are considered acceptable in war to as a whole, perhaps not to individuals, but are not the same as actions that would be allowed in a not war situation. And obviously that's a huge can of worms and I'm generalizing it, but whether you agree with that or not, we have characters like Danny Pink, who is a professional or was a professional soldier. He obviously thought that that was the right thing to do, or he wouldn't have been a soldier. He's clearly killed other soldiers based on the answer he gave, and based on his tears, he also has clearly killed non-combatants, possibly, and we'll probably learn more about that in the future. That's why he cried. You know, there's something there. Maybe that's why he's no longer a soldier. Maybe he shot some civilians by mistake and couldn't deal with that, and then he considered that bad, whereas shooting another soldier is good. How is that any different from the Doctor destroying Daleks, or destroying Cybermen, or destroying the Suntarans when they're trying to blow up another world or take over somebody? Why is that wrong for them to wipe out the humans? Why, you know, instead have the humans wipe out the Daleks? I mean, this is a very complicated issue. And the fact that the Doctor is taking this anti-soldier stance far further than he, except perhaps for David Tennant, who was unusually nasty to UNIT without, undeservedly so, I thought.
But what about Pertwee and the Silurians?
Well, yes, he was mad at them for particular actions, but he didn't dismiss them out of hand like the Brigadier. He wouldn't have, if the Brigadier had walked up to him and said, "Take me with you, Doctor, now, anyway," assuming the Brigadier were still alive, he wouldn't just say, you know, "You're a soldier. Too bad," and kick them off. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is this setup that they're putting here, is that why the Doctor is asking the question, "Am I a good man?" Soldiers aren't good.
I think it's part of it. I think there's an interesting multi-layered response going on here. When Leela was traveling with the Doctor, I quite liked the way that she did things that he didn't approve of.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, what was going on there? I mean, I quite liked the fact that they were this kind of partnership, because he needed her in a way to do that.
Right.
But it was having his cake and eating it, because he could go around being terribly moral and disapproving of this stuff. But
it got the job done.
Yeah. And, you know, somewhat at arm's length. Now the Doctor is being very explicitly anti-military, and yet the Dalek is seeing in his mind, in his imagination, all this hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, by making it so explicit, we as the viewers are then given a choice about not the kind of simple thing, the kind of Tom Baker era of the way of interpreting the show would simply be the Doctor is the hero.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the Doctor is right. But here we're being given a choice. You know, Clara is very explicitly rejecting his attitude towards soldiers at the end, and we're getting Danny Pink, who I thought would be kind of crowbarred into this episode because I couldn't see how a School Hill teacher would have anything to do with this story about Daleks. And yet actually, and partly because of the clever structure, but partly because of the way it was framed, that contrast gives us a different perspective. We see there a soldier who is very clearly not going to fit this model that
the doctor's building.
Has in his mind, but also to some extent is realized on the ship, whose name I've temporarily forgotten.
Aristotle.
The Aristotle, thank you. By all of these kind of gung-ho military shoot him and sling him in a bag type characters.
But Journey Blue wasn't one. I mean, maybe at first she was, well, but at the end she disobeyed orders to go with the doctor. Remember?
Yes, she
blow
did.
Yourself up. So, I mean, she showed she could expand beyond the military mindset that the doctor is condemning her for.
I agree. And we've seen that. We're being shown that as the viewers. And the doctor is unable to see that. It's the prejudice that Clara called him out for. But she called him out for it in relation to Daleks.
Which makes no sense. I mean, he goes through the Dalek, points out the whole nine yards. The Dalek is engineered to be what we would call evil. The fact that he hates them is not. I don't see that as as big a problem as he sees it. Harken back to Troughton. There are things that this universe comes from corners of this universe that are evil, and they must be fought. That was one of Troughton's most famous speeches. Not that I've quoted it correctly, but how is it any different? The Daleks are evil by they're engineered to be evil. It's not just I have a different point of view here. Maybe they're not
there's a more fundamental philosophical problem. The Daleks aren't things; they are living beings. Every living being is capable of redemption. That seems to be a creed, even if I can't quote it explicitly. It's a theme that runs strongly through Doctor Who, almost as far back. But you can't have them both. It's like when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object, what happens?
We never see this moral dilemma.
The premise is flawed. You can't have both of these things. You can't have something that is completely evil and at the same time say every living being is capable of redemption. If you have one exception, what's to stop you saying, actually, there are others? It's a flawed rule.
So what is the... why is it that we're getting this whole... the doctor is perhaps prejudiced against the Daleks, and we're beginning a lot of hand-wringing for the last several Dalek episodes concerning the doctor's absolute hatred of the Daleks, when we don't get that with the Cybermen, and the Cybermen are no different. They are organic beings as well that have been reprogrammed to be evil.
Well, I think we do get something like that with the Cybermen, although it's a kind of slightly different thing because they're on a journey to being dehumanized. So in Age of Steel, you get that scene that's taken from Spare Parts with the partially converted Cyber Bride.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're getting with this kind of Dalek redemption thing is it comes from Dalek and it comes from Jubilee before that, because
Jubilee being a big finish for our listeners.
Yeah, the audio, the Rob Shearman's audio on which he based the TV episode Dalek, or at least which some of it comes from. In Jubilee, you get Evelyn's reaction to the Doctor, who she knows to be this person who is compassionate and doesn't have prejudices about any race that she's come across before, suddenly react in a way to the Daleks that seems completely alien to her. And what she sees is a creature that is helpless and trapped. That's the same dynamic we get to see with Rose, and that's the dynamic that we are seeing here with Clara, because she expects the Doctor to react in a different way, because with every other race he does. And yet suddenly here you have some creature that is so beyond the pale that the Doctor is not even willing to contemplate the possibility that there might be redemption.
So after we've seen this particular episode and we've seen how it was resolved with Clara turning on the memory bits that were suppressed in the computer memory of the Dalek, does that mean that if we took every Dalek creature, the mutant, and took them out of their casings, they could then become good? Because it's apparently the evil machine in there making them evil.
It's always seemed to me possible that if what you've got is the result of biological engineering, essentially, you've taken away certain aspects of, I would say, human, but obviously they're Dahls or Khaleds or whatever, and you've created something that is super efficient as a killing machine and good at survival, but doesn't have any of those attributes like compassion and empathy. But if that is something biologically engineered, why couldn't you reverse engineer it? And isn't it possible that rather than being entirely removed, some of these things are dormant? So that to me did seem a plausible. The fact that the Dalek could become suggestible at that moment would have meant that any Dalek could become suggestible. The problem, of course, was that what the doctor then suggested to it didn't produce the reaction that he had expected. He wasn't able to. It's a complicated process. And I hate it in stories like this when they say, hey, you know what? If I could just do this and do that, and then I could give him this memory or this thought, then suddenly he'd be all good. And they know exactly what effect their either biological or psychological tinkering is going to have. But of course, an organism with consciousness is an incredibly complicated entity. How could you possibly know all of that stuff?
I'm kind of dissatisfied with the notion that we had the Dalek brain and the electronic brain, because I think it's been pretty consistent throughout the history of the Daleks that the Dalek inside the machine is what has been engineered biologically to have all those things removed. And yet in this episode, that doesn't appear to be the case. It appears to be the case that the machine is keeping those things removed from the Dalek, which is a bit of a change in the
well, it wasn't that it was keeping things that had been removed. What it was doing was acting as a kind of, it's like the Dalek's time machine, in the Apple sense, rather than time machine in the sense of being a time machine. You know, the Dalek is backing up its memories from its biological brain to an external electronic storage.
Which is then getting parts of it turned off so that it can't see them. So who...
Yes, I'm not quite... Yes.
Where does that decision get made?
How they got turned off, yes.
Good question. There's no mechanism. Does the Dalek actively go, yep, that's a bad thing. Keep the star being born away from me. Or is something else making that decision and taking it away from him so that he will not be tainted by soft puppies and little daisies in the field and kittens and things?
Yes, I think that's a valid point. I would have to watch it again.
I don't think you'll get a good good explanation at the end. I mean, I think it's not, it's kind of hand waved across as to why those memories got turned off. There's no real
other memories didn't.
Yeah, there's really nothing. I mean, why does a Dalek really need any memories? For the most part, not sure. So
yes, I mean, it could be a reaction to having been damaged, but yeah, I'm speculating here. I'm trying to fill in what is obviously a gap. So yeah, I think that's a fair point.
Anyway, the other thing that disturbed me about this cycle in the episode is that the Doctor is at the beginning is an unreasoning hatred of the Daleks. They want him to help the Dalek because the Dalek is saying, destroy the Daleks, destroy the Daleks. The Doctor doesn't want to help until he hears the Dalek say, destroy the Daleks. And then he's like, oh, wow, okay, a good Dalek. A Dalek that wants, that's his definition of a good Dalek. That's their definition of a good Dalek. He goes back and grabs Clara, and although we don't hear him explain the whole thing to her, the way the episode is edited, it comes off and she's like, a good Dalek. And the Doctor's like, how could I resist? Okay, so this is the Doctor trying to redeem a Dalek. I mean, he at the beginning of the episode, he's kind of trying to redeem the Dalek, but he already knows that this good Dalek is going to go try to destroy Daleks. I mean, it's explicit. Then we go through the process. He fixes the Dalek, and the Dalek is like, okay, I'm a Dalek now. He then fixes it again so that it's quote-unquote good, and it goes, okay, I'm going to go destroy the Daleks. And the Doctor's now like, no, that's not what I wanted you to do. Like, isn't that what you wanted him to do at the beginning? Isn't that where we started? It didn't really seem to evolve differently. It's not like the Dalek at the beginning was saying, I need to play with puppies. And the Doctor goes, wow, I have to save this Dalek. He's a kind, gentle Dalek. He was a Dalek who wanted to kill other Daleks. And that's what I feel like they didn't really understand the journey they were going on in this story, because we just went from A to B to A. And then suddenly A is bad.
when the initial problem was you had a damaged Dalek. So you thought it was a good Dalek, but that it was damaged and it needed medical attention or a mechanic or whatever Daleks need. And then it turns out that obviously the two things are connected. So from the soldier sense, probably what they ended up with was what they wanted, which was they got a fit Dalek that wanted to kill other Daleks. And at the start, they had an ill Dalek that wanted to kill other Daleks. So they got what they wanted. From the Doctor's point of view, I'm not quite sure it's that simple, because he's seeing a Dalek who's saying, I want to kill other Daleks, and seeing that as a symptom of maybe being a good Dalek, but not necessarily, in the sense that it's atypical, but not necessarily being something that he would want a Dalek to do, having looked in his mind and seen his hatred.
Is this the dilemma that he had in Genesis of the Daleks Revisited? The Time Lords originally gave him the mission of either destroying the Daleks or altering their evolution so that they become less aggressive. Is this him hoping to achieve that now? So if I can loose a good Dalek on the other Daleks, maybe he can turn the other Daleks good. I've changed the path.
I think it is in part, but I think partly what we are seeing is that the Doctor isn't actually being entirely consistent in his definition of good. You know, the whole question about am I a good man or a good Dalek? I mean, partly you've got the ambiguity, as in, is a good Dalek a Dalek who is morally good, or is he just good at being a Dalek? The sense they're using it in is that he's a morally good Dalek because he's fighting on the right side. Yeah?
That's a good question. I think good and bad's not the easiest.
Well, that's the sense it's being used in there. But the Dalek who wants to go and kill other Daleks, all it's doing is what the soldiers are doing, which is going and killing Daleks.
Mm-hmm.
But the Doctor, while the Doctor gets excited about the Dalek who wants to do that, he doesn't approve of the soldiers who want to do that. I mean, maybe he regards them as a necessity, but it's obviously something that he is deeply ambivalent about, to the point where he's unwilling to take Journey Blue with him because that's what she does. Mm. So his definition of good isn't being applied equally to Daleks and humans.
So do we have, I'll ask the question about fatalism. So in humans, fatalism is not usually considered a particularly good trait that people have. There's that sort of, you know, there's no point. Why should I go on? That's, you know, short path to suicide, or can be. In the case of the Dalek, his goodness comes from fatalism. There's no point in me trying to destroy the universe. It's just going to keep coming back again. Isn't that what they're saying there? I mean, that is Dalek fatalism. Not much point in trying to wipe this thing out. It's just going to keep growing back. It's like weeds. I thought that was kind of a funny way to look at it when it was explaining why the star being born made it realize the futility of its way.
Yes, it's maybe not good as in, it's maybe good as in better than the alternative, which is a Dalek who wants to destroy everything.
Up to destroying the entire universe and the entire fabric of time and the universe in Parting of the Ways, or whichever one it was that they were, their reality bomb. Maybe that's why. It's like, if we get rid of everything, it can't grow back. So maybe the Daleks have known about this all along. Maybe that's why that's a suppressed memory.
Yeah, or, you know, this could be a timey-wimey thing. We don't know which. There are no new paradigm Daleks here. These are your proper old-fashioned new Daleks.
Yeah, medium generation new Daleks, yeah.
Medium generation. And hooray for that, I say. You know, if we don't see the new paradigm again, that'll be too soon.
Oh, I didn't mind the new paradigm Daleks, but they do look a little cumbersome. I got nothing against colors. I don't like Daleks, so.
They look like iPods.
See, and they don't even do that anymore, so, or do they? See, back when they were colorful, bright, shiny colored iPods, plastic.
They probably now changed it after Victory of the Daleks.
Yeah.
As the Apple executive for watching that show and, oh my God, you know, we must go switch to our range to being
brushed aluminum.
Gray and, yeah.
Brushed aluminum with some anodized colors instead, but. Okay, so let's talk about the Ross who dies We mentioned that a little bit earlier. The Doctor very pragmatically chucks him a power cell to swallow. Everyone assumes the Doctor is trying to save him, but in fact, he's trying to save themselves. Is he trying to save himself, or is he trying to save the situation, or is there a difference there?
I don't think there's a difference.
Okay. Would the Doctor have done that in one of those morality tests where if he chucked it to this guy to swallow, it would have saved five other people but would have no effect on him whatsoever? You know, it's just, I didn't get anything out of it that the Doctor was cowardly saving himself. Let's put it that way.
I agree about that.
Coldly, analytically calculating.
Yes.
Further,
and what's remarkable about it is it's very, very different from what he said when he was looking out from the spaceship over Victorian London. And he said, I prefer it down there because they're not small to me. To me, the implication is every individual counts.
But if he can't save them, there's just no way to save them that his brain can think of. So let's take it to Gretchen. Two things I want to mention about Gretchen. The first is, the Doctor completely stood passively by as she sacrificed her life. He neither encouraged her nor discouraged her. He made no effort to stop her from killing herself. He did give her a slight reassurance that he'll do, when she asked him point blank, will you do something awesome with it? And I'll say, great, I'll do that. Now, Gretchen dies and wakes up in heaven with Missy, the annoying woman who I'm not going to like as the big bad this season. She killed herself and she ended up there. Does that tell us whether Mr. Halfface killed himself last time?
Well, it strongly suggests it, yes, but
people who are inspired to die on behalf of the Doctor,
yes,
lay down their lives for that, for what he believes in.
Yes.
I just wonder if that's the theme, because we didn't see Ross go to heaven.
No. It looked like that to me, but I will say, I mean, in the last episode, it was a kind of epilogue that I was quite happy should be tacked on to the end of the story. In this episode, heaven gets in the way because I liked that scene. It is the cold Doctor we're getting again, where I think by saying he'll do something excellent, he is really giving her actions an endorsement.
Yes. He
is encouraging her. I don't think you can get around that. It's a powerful moment, and I think suddenly interjecting heaven in there detracts from that. Now, whether that's intentionally detracting because it's too strong a moment for a family show, or whether it's just been inserted in there because it's the arc story this season and they needed to stick it in somewhere and that was the place to do it. Who can say?
Two things. But I mean,
it did weaken it for me.
It also weakens her death.
Yes, exactly.
In other words, she's not really dead. I mean, maybe she's dead, but she's not really dead, as opposed to body gone, that's it, end of thing. So it may be cushioning it for kids or you know, taking the impact of basically a suicide on camera away. So here's the other question. Is it relevant in any way that the effect of her going to heaven was no different than the effect of Journey Blue being materialized inside the TARDIS?
Good question. Excellent question.
Please, please, please don't let Missy be a Time Lord. There just aren't any Time Lords out there that this can be. She can't be. She can't be. She's too crazy. I'm already dislike her. She's crazy in the John Sims master crazy kind of way, and I didn't like the John Sims crazy master kind of way, so I'm not liking Missy already. She seems nuts.
I think she's more crazy in the Eric Roberts master kind of way, but
that too. Okay, yeah, that was not
I
a good
fall out with you over that.
That was not a good look for the master there either. So,
but I have nothing on that. I have no theories at all. I
just noticed it on the second view, and I said, yeah, it's the same effect. I hope it doesn't mean, you know, it wasn't accompanied with a TARDIS materialization noise or anything like that at the beginning. So,
I think we're going to need at least another episode to confirm or refute that apparent pattern.
Couple things. The Doctor's relationship with Clara. He takes quite a few digs at her. Her hips, she's built like a man. which is clearly not meant to be an insult, as far as I can tell. It's that one seems to be a completely careless remark. I mean, that seems like somebody saying, "Does this dress make me look fat?" and answering yes, because it does. I mean, it seems like somebody who just does not know when they should shut up or lie. Yes. But on the other hand, his comments about her getting old and, oh, well, you know, at least you're still making an effort, as if she's old enough, she should have given up and stopped bothering trying to find somebody, or those, that's not quite the same. Is that?
Oh, I thought it was. I didn't take it as being intended.
But don't those have to be kind of true? I mean, does he really think Clara's getting old and run down? For him to say those things without... I couldn't quite tell where they were going. I mean, they're funny, and I enjoyed them immensely at Clara's expense. But I couldn't quite... I thought it was more tied into his inability to identify humans very well. Like when he came back and says, this is Gun Girl and this is Boss Man, who might be her uncle, but I don't know. Are you the same people as last time?
Yeah. I think that's part of it, but it's not just a question about humans. It's a question about being tuned in to the particular. I mean, we talk about conventions or social mores or whatever around, you know, whether you would say, "Does this dress make me look fat?" How you'd answer that question. That's very specifically, you know, about a late 20th century kind of question. You might. This question about whether Clara is old or not would be answered differently if you took it to a different century. If you're looking at the 19th century or whatever, surely she would be.
27, I suppose.
She would be considered to be, you know, this is...
An old maid?
Yeah, I mean, Sense and Sensibility or whatever. How old is... I can't even remember the name of the character. But, it's there you have characters who are, when they're in their 20s, they are seen as being old, and, you know, it's too late.
I think the Japanese have a phrase about women, where they used to, referring to them as Christmas cake. If you're 26, nobody wants Christmas cake on the day after Christmas.
That I'm agreeing with the sentiment.
Right, but it's...
I like Christmas cake even after Christmas.
Well, yeah, I shall stop
digging now. No, what I mean is the point about whether about even looking at human society is more parochial than that. We are looking at a tiny window of time within human society, and these kinds of mores change, and we are expecting the Doctor to be able to pick up on those things within human society within the early 21st century, and maybe he's not always going to be able to do that.
Okay, I only have one more thing that I can think of offhand that has to do with the soldiering, actually. And that is, I think Danny Pink has been set up as being somebody who we're going to see again. I don't think he was just in this episode. I think there's bound to be some situation where the Doctor encounters him. They spent way too much time talking about Clara's smile. How much she was smiling. So he'll be back.
And yes, I think he will be.
And that's a sense of conflict.
What I thought was clever about the way the episode was written was that his introduction added something to the episode and the whole question about being good and about fighting.
Because we've set up Danny to be a soldier who has similar doubts.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So that works within the episode, but to frame it in that way would be very odd unless he were not being set up as a recurring character that we're going to see again. And in particular, I want as soon as that tear appears, I want to know the story behind that. I think we're going to find out more.
I agree. I don't know for a fact. I'll go so far as to say that that's not something I've been spoiled on, but I'm pretty sure that we'll probably have to know that story at some point. Just like I think we'll ultimately see what happened at the end of Deep Breath in Flashback. They will eventually show us whether the Doctor pushed him or whether he jumped. I think that will have to be resolved.
Maybe, although I'm quite happy for it not to be.
What about the potential? So the Doctor's got this thing against soldiers. We know he's going to come up against Danny Pink, or we think he's going to come up against Danny Pink at some point, for some reason. What about UNIT? Well, we've had some pretty good, the Doctor, the 11th Doctor, had some pretty good relationship working with UNIT, unlike David Tennant's Doctor. Is that going to be a problem if they show up again? They're all soldiering.
Is it a problem for the Doctor?
Well,
I mean,
is it a story conflict that's going to come up? Is that going to be something? Will he grant them any kind of, what about Kate Stewart, who seems to be on friendly terms with him? Will he no longer be on friendly terms?
She is UNIT's scientific advisor. He can't really say being scientific advisor to UNIT.
She's not scientific advisor. Person. Kate Stewart is the head of UNIT. It's Scarf Girl that's the scientific advisor.
Is she?
Yeah.
Kate Stewart is the head of UNIT?
Yep. She is the head of UNIT, at least the British end of it.
Okay.
Well, she's not exactly military.
She certainly doesn't.
She's more science-oriented than military, but I don't even know if she has a rank. I don't think they ever said, but she did when they first introduced him in Power of Four. I think that's when she first showed up.
Power of Three, yes.
Power of Three, Power of Four, Power of Three. What's the difference?
Power of Four is the sequel. We haven't had that yet.
Great. Well, good. Maybe that'll explain what the heck was going on in that story. Maybe we'll get that guy back and we'll figure out what the heck was going on there.
Okay. I had thought, and I obviously misinterpreted the episode, but I thought she was in the same role that the Doctor, as in the Third Doctor, had been to UNIT. But yes, okay.
But she is more science-oriented because she did say something to that effect, like, my dad always said that science should lead UNIT or something like that. So she may be a scientist per se, but she is the head, and Scarf Girl is quote-unquote the scientific advisor. So UNIT has changed some in the intervening years. It's headed by a civilian, but nonetheless, she is exercising military power. She is in charge of the troops, and so I don't know. I'm just wondering if we'll see that conflict played out as well with the new Doctor.
Well, there's a conflict in the offing. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see Kate Stewart back in any capacity because I thought it was great having UNIT back in that form. But I don't necessarily relish it being more confrontational.
It was. I mean, I really alluded to it earlier. I really disliked David Tennant's completely, utterly dismissive attitude to UNIT.
The minute
he walked in.
UNIT were pretty awful.
They were pretty awful, but he was only bitching about him before they did thing one, except for retrieve him, which I know he would be a little miffed about, but you know, he didn't give them the slightest chance at all before he was already on the commanding officer. They're obviously just a limited military mind. The guy hadn't said anything, practically, and he was already on him. So I felt they were writing that too strongly for the situation. I thought when Pertree was complaining about the military, it was always in response to them, the Brigadier actually expressing an idea that he didn't like, or performing a course of action like in the Silurians that he didn't like. But they were obviously helpful and useful to him in the same way Leela was, because he would sometimes say, hey, Brigadier, why don't you send some people around to take a look at that? Or
yeah, although that was a relationship that I felt had been built slowly after a kind of initial ambivalence on the Doctor's part, that it was because of the Doctor's growing respect for the Brigadier that he began to take to and engage with UNIT more and more. But initially he was only there because that was a way of getting the instruments and supplies that he needed.
Not necessarily true with the Second Doctor, though, in Invasion.
True.
And even in Web of Fear, he was kind of, you know, warming to them even in that episode. So there was just a lot of, I mean, Web of Fear, there was a lot of paranoia. We just don't know who the agent is, so.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you that the Tenth Doctor was more anti-UNIT. I'm just thinking about it in terms of degrees rather than being an absolute stance.
All right. Well, have you got anything that?
The only other thing I can think of is the number of episodes that this reminded me of, which, you know, should have made it feel more derivative than it did. It didn't really, but you know, the miniaturization thing, Carnival of Monsters sprung to mind. The Invisible Enemy, since sort of popped into my head. Let's Kill Hitler. Dalek, we've talked about. The similarities with that, although I think it takes a different path once we kind of, you know, the Dalek doesn't come good. It doesn't just want to see the sunlight or whatever. And also, to some extent, similarities with the Beast Below, which is also about going inside a creature, albeit without being miniaturized.
Right.
So quite a few things that kind of popped up in my head as being similar to it, but not in any way to the detriment of the story.
No, I think it was. I think it was fine. I think the fact that they were obviously Invisible Enemy is quite derivative of Fantastic Voyage. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's no point in trying to hide that one. That just is Fantastic Voyage, with the added element of the Doctor going into himself.
Yeah. And this one has a good twist on that makes, because it's inside a Dalek, that makes it something uniquely Doctor Who.
It actually seems more realistic.
Yeah.
I can't believe I just used that phrase. But I mean, it seems more realistic because you're climbing inside basically a machine. So it's not like you have to swim around in goo or stuff. So
and cool, because you actually get to see that I mean, you mentioned before that Daleks are portrayed as being this kind of feat of biological engineering. That's where all the kind of scientific effort has gone. And to some degree, they've just been shoved into these dustbins because they are functional and they can strap high energy weapons onto them. Mm. But actually, in this, and to some extent in
Daleks, they're a cyborg.
We get to see quite how sophisticated the transport machine part is and how much it adds. So yeah, as you say, they are a cyborg. They're more than just an organism in a vehicle. They're actually, there's a unity to the parts there, and the mechanical stuff is way, way more sophisticated.
I just can't quite figure out where Ian Chesterton was sitting inside the Dalek when he was in one in Dalek. I mean, having seen the inside now, like, it just doesn't seem like it's big enough for him. Is he like right on top of the atomic fuel supply there, or where did that go?
Yeah. Well, of course, they were fueled by the electricity in the floor, were they not?
Oh, that's true. That was very early.
So probably had a bit more. That left a bit of space.
Good point.
He said quickly.
All right. Well, in that case, thank you for joining me.
Yes, pleasure as always.
And next time, we will be looking at The Robots of Sherwood. I hope that wasn't a spoiler for you. I mean, that is next week's episode on Doctor Who, and also should be next week's episode on Fusion Patrol. So listeners, I hope you'll join us again next time here on the aforementioned Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.